are pleased to see you here. To be honest, I would have liked to work the sunny Cologne, but okay, now we have to do some work still. Revolution in military affairs, a buzz phrase. Is it really a buzz phrase? I believe not. But we will now explain a bit background, the meaning of this buzz phrase and its implications. Hans-Jörg and myself, we will do that in a type of role play, and I will start with the introduction. And Hans-Jörg, please give me a push when I don't stop talking. So, life has become extensively digital, and so has warfare. Although death is still analog, and especially on the battlefield, as horrible as it has ever been. It has been information technology and computer science which caused a dramatic change in military strategies and subsequently in public perception of military affairs. You may argue that informatics as a science is unsuspicious, innocuous, harmless. Nevertheless, computer science and information technology became the dominant technology or became a dominant role in military technologies and subsequently in military affairs from the beginning and with the pace increasing with technological progress. Yet it took half a century until in 1996 the General Staffs, United States General Staffs, issued the so-called Joint Vision 2010, 4 years later updated into the Joint Vision 2020, a position paper which basically demanded a thorough restructuring of the forces towards employing the entire range of ICT-based weapons. The joint vision introduced the scenarios of the so-called new wars. The new wars to be campaigned by means of networked battle units, globally networked battle units, including all sorts of unmanned combat vehicles. Hence, martial actions should be restricted or could be restricted to precision strikes to minimize collateral effects and to remote operations to spare soldiers' lives, certainly own soldiers. This was what then was called the revolution in military affairs. That is, to introduce the full range of ICT-based weapons, global communication control and command systems. Now, RMA, as it's called for short, was under President George W. Bush becoming the dominating political and military doctrine, and it became the baseline for defense policy and armament planning. Eventually, it was Barack Obama, Nobel laureate for peace, who fostered the doctrine of concentrating, focusing on cyber weapons, drones, and special forces, also known as Obama's way to war. Now, mostly unnoticed, the development of new doctrines, military as well as political doctrines, had a tremendous effect on society. And to see how and why, Hans-Jörg will now take a quick walk through the history of military computing. We will then talk about the ambivalent dual-use concept,
give some examples about recent weapon technology, special robot arms. Talk about, let's see, talk about how the implications are blurred by policy. Talk about the imminent dangers in ICT-based warfare. And finally, talk about our responsibilities. So Hans-Jörg, please.
Okay, the early history of computers is quite interrelated with military affairs. So for example, Konrad Zuse in Germany started in 1933 to develop his Z series. First of all, it was a private enterprise, but a few years later, he got significant amount of military funding, and he joined as an employee the Henschel Aircraft Factory, where he designed a special purpose computer for missile control, or more exactly speaking, to improve the flying behavior of the V-2. This was an early kind of cruise missile. In Great Britain, Turing, quite famous for his Turing machines and the basis for theoretical computer science, he also did some quite practical work. He designed, together with others clearly, the so-called Bombe special purpose computer. It was at Bletchley Park, where the government code and cyber school was sited, and the task was to decode the signals that were encrypted by the German Enigma encryption machine. And this was a quite successful project, and it is said that it was important for the battle in the Atlantic, to win the battle in the Atlantic for the Allied Marines. But the main development took place in the United States, starting a bit later than the other two examples. It was Eckert and Mauchly designing the so-called ENIAC computer, and this was meant for computation of ballistic tables. And this is more or less the kind of computer technology we are using still today. A bit later, IBM developed, based on this ENIAC concept, a stretch computer, and Remington Rand the LAR computer. This was a time where each computer had an individual name because there were only very few examples. And these both computers were for the development of the H-bomb. And more or less in parallel to this development, there was a whirlwind idea. This was a kind of real-time computer which was later on used in the SAGE system in the 50s, and this was the first, in this case, semi-automatic air defense system. And starting with the SAGE, there were several other computer programs and computer systems like this, the North American Defense System, ballistic missile, early warning, anti-ballistic missile system, and others. This meant that the military complex started to rely more and more on computers, and meaning on very, very large, very, very expensive, and extremely unreliable programs. Joseph Weizenbaum later warned of the danger that is involved in this situation, because he pointed out that these systems and all kinds of these systems, even those systems till today, are impenetrable. And he meant that it is impossible to understand them. It is impossible to build a second system with the same behavior. It is impossible to know the behavior, and so on. So this is, and his conclusion was such a system should not be developed and used. The problem was also known to the experts who developed these systems and who were responsible for all these projects. And this, therefore, in the 60s, there came up the so-called software crisis, meaning that software is too expensive and too unreliable, and one has to do something about this. The something was that the NATO organized a series of scientific conferences where the area of software engineering was established. They started to design a new programming language, ADA. It's still in use in these such applications. And ADA was a programming language, a standard language for the NATO area that replaced 300 programming languages in use in this time. Then in the 80s, they funded by lots of money, very high-speed integrated circuits development. There was a software technology project, STARS, starting in 83 with half a 500 millions of US dollars. And there was also, this STARS was a traditional software engineering program, and there was also strategic computing initiative, which was a push for artificial intelligence. So this program is worth 500 million of US dollar, and the idea was to come up with a battle management system, a pilot assistant system, and you see here the third direction of applications, unmanned vehicles that are able to run on ground and to avoid obstacles and to hide behind some helpful area parts. And on the right hand, you see that even very exotic ideas came up in this time, but even this exotic kind of animal was built in various versions. One is a scorpion. This was funded by the research agency of the Department of Defense of the United States, but developed at the GMD in Bonn. So only a little bit of the money went to foreign countries. This was one. And you see, this is my colleague in Bremen, Frank Kirchner. He is still working on this scorpion, but now it is intended to use it on a Mars mission. We will see. And I would like to mention the SDI project, in addition, Strategic Defense Initiative or Star Wars program, also started in 83. The idea is depicted here. If some missiles come from the Soviet Union, the United States tried to destroy it before it reaches the United States area. And this was the most gigantic project in this time. Several milliards of US dollar were intended to spend. It is still under development. It is still not working properly. But now it is called National Missile Defense. And you see that the picture is not only colorful now, This has to do with tick systems and things like this. But it is also a new world, because now the United States is on the right and the enemy is on the left without the possibility to identify it. So it is political correct now. What is a summary of all this? In the 70s and 80s, the military complex spent a lot of money, many, many millions, to push forward software engineering, artificial intelligence, and such. But at the same time, a kind of emancipation took place with respect to commercial and civil information and communication technology, and Dietrich will say a bit more.
Okay. We have just learned that computer technology was primarily born as a military technology. And it is increasingly applied for weapon technology. So how comes that information technology is no longer identified as a military technology? There are several reasons. Information technology is mostly invisible, especially when we talk about embedded systems or IT infrastructures. Take, for example, a drone. A drone is generally perceived as a type of aircraft. It's less visible that the body of such vehicles is crammed with IT. There's still far more IT behind its operation. So another reason, IT is the classical example of a dual-use technology. As soon as first computers had proven their usefulness in military applications, a rapid development of civil applications started. And nowadays, IT has invaded the last wrinkle of our personal life. And it's absolutely taken for granted that information technology is involved anywhere and anytime, hence why not in weapons? So to answer my question, it's the implicitness of information technology which veils its fundamental role in weapon technology. It's so to call also its dual-use nature, which serves for blindfolding society, and even computer professionals who are working in non-military areas. Although computer technology, information technology, is not only perceived as a civil technology, it is, in fact, a civil technology. Today's computers, military computers, military communication systems are built upon just the same technology as our civil applications. And the current state of those technologies, its performances, its reliability, its economy, is mainly due to the evolvement and to the prevalence of information technology in civil applications. Surprisingly, there seems to be no longer a genuine military computer technology, except of special areas, of course. Now, that has been different in the beginning when computers were military products, military technologies. However, with the proliferating IT applications in the civil area, it was simply a matter of quantity of turnover that civil applications became the driving force behind the technological progress. There are still reasons, of course, to maintain a military computer technology on a parallel track, of course. Special type of computer chips, special type of operating systems, communication protocols, and so on. However, meanwhile, the elements of IT products and IT systems have become so sophisticated and complex that it is virtually impossible to develop an alternative and competitive technology from scratch, at least not in a reasonable span of time. The current technology had rather to undergo a very long process of evolution, mutation, selection, survival of the fittest, and all what nature taught us about evolution. The result of that evolution, or say the evolution was the result of the billions of computer applications, of the billions of computers which we bought and applied for. So everybody of us has already unwillingly and certainly unnoticed paid a bit for the evolution of computers also in military application. Say it was our expenditure in computer equipment and communication equipment which fueled industry's investments into the ongoing improvement and optimization of the delicate and costly manufacturing processes. Another way around, military applications need indispensably civil computer or information technology research and development. The result, as a result, we are faced with a gray area between military and civil R&D, which is still spreading. Hans Jörg will now give an example of such a gray area technology, robots. Robots which best demonstrate the dangerous merge between civil and military research, and now forgot to give you all the keywords here, but okay. Take it, please.
Yeah, robotics is such a gray area, developed quite with quite a lot of money at the moment. But I start to show you or say a bit about the very, very black part of this area, or if you prefer as a color, the blood red part. These are armed robots and robot arms, and some of them, or better say, let me start with this observation. The United States have a roadmap that started in 2007 and runs to 2032, and the other even to 2037. And the plan is to replace a large part of current weaponry by unmanned combat vehicles on air, ground, sea, everywhere, everything. Some of them are already in existence, so these killer drones are quite well known, Predator and Reaper. Predator has 2 Hellfire missiles, and Reaper has 8 Hellfire missiles. But there are also ground and sea and underwater vehicles. So the Talon SWAT, for example, is just a machine gun running on its own. And this is already in use. I'm not so sure about the sea-based vehicles, but at least they are under development. They look very similar to traditional weapons, tanks, aircrafts, and so on, but they would not exist without the use of scientific results, the use of in particular information and communication technology and computer science methods. For example, all of them are embedded systems where computers are embedded. They have a digital control. They are connected to communication networks. They need a lot of image processing and evaluation of other sensors. So they have the big data problem. And the idea is to use artificial intelligence to solve all these problems. And they must be still solved because especially the autonomy of these armed robots is still not working well enough so that it cannot be really used, but it is intended to use. So quite a lot of research is done in this respect. For example, also in Germany, Wünsche in Munich, Paulus in Koblenz, Bayerer in Karlsruhe have large research groups. They never do it alone. They have groups to and spending a lot of money working on such problems to make robots more autonomous, especially military robots, for already more than most of them a decade, so it needs quite a lot of time, and so far it does not work very well. And on another example, how military robot development and universities are related is, for example, the NATO competition for underwater robots that takes place every year in different NATO places, and there are especially students' teams invited to compete with each other. Today, the autonomy does not working, but it is intended to have, the plan is to have autonomous armed robots. So today, still the killer drones are launched, the missiles of killer drones are launched by human soldiers doing their killing. But coming soon, I expect, at least these are the plans, these robots will kill autonomously, and this means that they decide about life and death themselves. The robot will kill if started, but nevertheless, the wars of law, the laws of war, still are valid, and especially the Geneva Convention has to be obeyed, and this means that these robots have to distinguish between combatants and civilians, because civilians are not allowed to be killed. They have to save cultural goods. They have to work ethically correct in this respect, in the respect of the laws of war. And there are colleagues here, for example, Ron Arkin at the Georgia Institute of Technology. He is convinced that this is not only possible, but very desirable to have machine ethics. He says this robots, one of the reasons is robots never panic, in contrast to human soldiers, and robots are quite able to judge orders and refuse them if they are inappropriate, so it is no great difficulty to come up with an artificial conscience. I did not add another reason here. If such a robot is destroyed, the people in the United States are not so, get not nervous as they get when human soldiers are killed. Just to summarize, we have a contrary view. we think that the program conscience is impossible. It will never work, at least not for a long time, in any way correctly. It will not be possible that machines can observe the laws of war. One simple reason is that the laws of war may be not computable, but there are other reasons why it does not work. At least nobody knows how they can be computed, and the consequence should be that weapons like this should be banned, as biological and chemical weapons, and I refer you here to the campaign by the International Committee of Robot Arms Control, and I hope very much that they will be successful. So this all is the black area, but there is also a civil counterpart of robotics. So you know about the RoboCup, and you may have heard about rescue robot development, and a huge amount of money is spent to build robots that help senior and handicapped people. That's amazing, a lot of money. And I'm not sure that it is really a wide area, but it is somewhat between black and white.
So, okay, hopefully I don't forget this time. Okay, robots are a really alarming example of the disastrous merge between black and white, between military and civil IT. There's no other weapon system which does so much rely on advanced information technology and advanced computational methods than autonomous combat robots. I even believe that in many cases, civil research programs on robots, even contests, as you said, are financed or, let's say, driven by military objectives. So, but let's come back to what I stated before. Civil information technology is an indispensable foundation and resource for military applications. Hence, it is of no interest of the involved industry to keep both areas apart. The merge between the two areas is even enforced by political measures on the national and European level. So, how's that sold to us citizens? First, an euphemistic parlance is being introduced. The new terms are spelled security research, security technology, security architecture, and so on. Then appropriate structures are being implemented. I give you a recent example. A couple of years ago, five institutes of Fraunhofer Gesellschaft, who were already involved in security research programs, were united with three institutes of FGAN, that's the Forschungsgesellschaft für angewandte Naturwissenschaften, a genuine military research facility. The new, this new group was then called the Fraunhofer Group for Defense and Security Research, in short, WWS. And now, research with civil objectives and research with military objectives were conducted under one roof, and the young scientist who possibly was committed with research on autonomous robots may never get to know whether his or her results of research end up in weapons. Next is to create budgets, governmental budgets. Red-Green kept still aloof, but as soon as Black-Yellow took over, Minister Chavan put security research on the agenda as a part of her 6 billion, that's in 6 milliarden, 6 billion high-tech strategy. Or take the European Commission's security research program. It is endowed with a lush budget of 1.4 billion. And the well-known index project is one project of that program. Now, part of that money is ending up in university and federal research facilities. And it's so to call of advantage that particularly universities are forced to take profit of that trickle-down effect, because they are suffering from an ever-increased pressure to raise third-parties funds. And they do it, they take the money, of course, at a loss of transparency, because I at least suspect that in many cases the real purposes of those budgets are blurred in order to undermine, for example, civil clauses. In the rare case, they even exist. And I think it's interesting that it bothers nobody that we all, again, pay for military developments, for military R&D, to say, so to call indirectly, in excess of the money, of the part of our tax money, which is already directly devoted to the governmental defense budget. Now, okay. There are other areas, of course, where R&D, military and civil, make profit of each other. But there's no other area than information technology where the merge, the amalgamation of both is of such importance, and at the same time, so much taken for granted. And I believe that's the reason for the amazing fact that RMA, the revolution, went on mostly unnoticed. Again, the reason is the ubiquity and implicitness of its very substance, information technology. However, RMA is a revolution, at least for the military strategist. And in the run, the new options of warfare had a significant effect on political attitudes towards conflict solving. Information technology provides, with drones and cyber weapons, the means for undercover warfare, undeclared without much notice of the public. Okay, Hans-Jörg, supposedly that's your turn to talk about the implications.
That's the proper one. So what we observe in military warfare in the recent here means the last 20 years at least, that there's quite a lot of fighting terrorism, and here the killer drones are used quite a lot, there is this tendency to merge civil and military security. There are so-called smart weapons, which are, as far as I can understand them, only seemingly smart, but I refer here to the unmanned vehicles. Then, just mentioned by Dietrich, there's cyber warfare. Now this is a kind of arms race that started about 10 years ago. It is a global arms race where very, very many states in the world develop units that can run cyber attacks, at least, so it is very dangerous what happens there. Then there is this phenomenon of asymmetry, so that one part of the war is using high-tech weapons while the other one is more or less reduced to low-level fighting, including suicide bombing. All this, and this is, I think, quite important to know for us, is quite dependent on ICT. The next point is more or less independent of ICT, and this is the observation that the political, industrial, and military complex keeps all options for all kinds of war. Industry may be understandable because they want to make profit. Military, I'm not so sure, I don't know, maybe this is just their kind of thinking. Politically, it is a disaster because it is definitely against the law of wars with respect, for example, to the UN Charter, where all the signing nations signed that they will solve their problems by peaceful matters. And so there would be no need to be able to attack anybody at all. So if all the states would concentrate on defense, we would have at least a very less arm race than today. I may mention that, for example, our constitutional laws in Germany say explicitly that the Bundeswehr has nothing to do rather than defense. But if you compare it with what they do really, then the reality is different. There is an interesting other nearly contradicting phenomenon. On one hand, we have ICT within the weapons, but in some sense, one can also say that the weapons are hided by ICT. You see this with the control centers that are far away from the battlefield, so the people at the control center have nothing than the computer screens to do their work. The same or similar things happens with the cyber attack. They are attractive for military people because you can save the own soldiers, at least if you attack. If you are attacked, then it may be different. You can cause a lot of damage, and the damage can be in military infrastructure or machinery, but it can also be and will be quite in the civil infrastructure, and it can be extremely disastrous in future. And one aspect for the military area that may be attractive of cyber attacks is they are hard to attribute to the attacker. And a similar phenomenon will happen if there are really autonomous armed robots, and if they are cheap and available everywhere, then it will be difficult to know who is attacking. And The last observation I would discuss a bit is that war, and this refers especially to Germany, war is meant to become a normal, acceptable, attractive, and permanent reality. I mean that especially in Germany, there's some effort from the military and political part necessary because the people in Germany are not very keen to run wars. And what happens now is that there are misleading advertisements by the Bundeswehr. For example, you see to the right there's an offer of a holiday camp for kids. So war is obviously a kind of holiday adventure. You may look up what the Bundeswehr is running now as campaign. Wir dienen Deutschland. This is a very awful campaign. You see the three dots, wir dot, dienen dot, Deutschland dot, because all three aspects of this, there are very, very strange statements given. And, for example, you may have seen already, there's recently a postal stamp where you may, which just says Bundeswehr is in service for Germany, but I would like to remind that Bundeswehr is not meant to be in service, it is meant to be ready for defense and nothing else.
So, finally, I would like point into some messages. First message, stop sleepwalking into a technology-driven defense policy. We are double blindfolded by the comfortable ubiquity of information technology and at the same time by the unobtrusive discrete use in weapon systems. So what we need experts, we need watchful observers, and we need to push politicians to be informed about what's going on. So take your part in that. Next, employ your expert knowledge to enhance public awareness. The easiness of employment IT in our daily life pretends simplicity and at the same time omnipotence. But it hides its complexity and its shortcomings, like vulnerability, lack of reliability, lack of controllability. So knowledge and experience is required for responsible forecast and scenarios. So become an alerter. Engage yourself. There are brave people who stand up against fatal developments, but as soon as they are involved in debates, they are fought down by phony arguments of their opponents. They are in dire need for expert knowledge. Help them to keep their position in serious debates. Try to recognize your own potential involvement in weapon development. Try to track back budget resources. Unveil the abuse of the dual-use term. Initiate debates on ethics among those responsible for R&D, policy, and political decisions. Ask questions like, who is responsible? Or in the case of autonomous robots, how can the laws of war, like the Geneva Convention, be respected by machines? Is that at all reasonable? Is computer ethics an option? And further questions. Consider to foster a rigorous ban of all weapon systems which serve public control. There's a very good example. 3-4 years ago, the International Committee for Robot Arms Control, ICRAC, has been founded, which tries to establish a ban on autonomous combat robots. So, last but not least, support computer professionals who decline to take their part in military R&D. Help them to take their bearings in their professional environment and to find alternatives. So, what should I say? Join FIF, because FIF has a lot of activities on that area. There's history in, let's say, peace topics. We have just empowered again a working group which is working on informatics, information technology in weapons. And this year, our annual conference in October at Siegen is devoted to the topic cyber peace. So, thank you for listening. Yeah, question, Laura. Okay, that was exactly the arguments which my wife brought up when we talked about the purpose of our talk. That's a really difficult question. So, but okay, as I said in our messages, one hand we have to try to wake up public attention to see what happens, because one of the messages of our talk was that there's so much going on hidden behind, veiled with buzzwords and so on, and I think the public is really not knowing what is going on. So, okay, you are experts, and you are able to understand what's going on, and you may take your part in, let's see, at least to try to put up a certain public conscience, public attention about things. Yeah, okay, well, but better you okay, it's a bit difficult for us to repeat the question, but we can take the microphone then and okay. So it's for the recording, I suppose. So.
I'm not sure that it still works because I think the deadline did it. The question was whether landmines are not a very good example of such a ban because they are banned, and they are all landmines are already a kind of autonomous weapon,
yes,
without activity in its own, but without launching by human beings directly. So I agree totally. That's a very good example, and armed robots may be even more dangerous. Maybe even more dangerous. So they should be banned definitely.
Kaibots. Okay.
I just wanted to add something as a comment to this GPL and licensing model. Of course, there's a contradiction somehow to have something free available for everybody, so why not for the military? Yeah? But if we develop software, if we develop systems, whatever, we can optimize them for military use, or we can do something different with that. Perhaps that's the first approach to come with it, in a more peaceful way to develop things that are not optimized for military use, like used outside in rain and under strange conditions and things like that. Perhaps just giving an idea what I mean.
Any more questions?
I have two questions. Would it be useful in scientific research to have like a license, like have a CC license, which prohibits certain thing and says you can't change it or you can't modify it, for scientific research to have a kind of license which forbids use in military stuff that you don't have this dual use? And the other one is like you had this machine gun, kind of caterpillar thing. I don't see if you put it out in the field in an environment where you really have to look at this thing instead of a drone which is flying around, nobody can catch it so easy, but I think this one could be stolen really easy. Or like you catch a bear, you catch this thing with a box, then you have a machine gun. Why would you put it out?
I think there's a certain difference. Say, when we talk about software licensees, then it's a something which may be of interest for the industry, let's say, to keep it low or whatever. But if we talk about some things like licensing the use of for the application of research results for, let's say, civil or military, it's under a political interest that it doesn't, that there, let's say, should be no restrictions. So policy, all the power of policy is behind it. Behind policy, of course, behind it is the power of industry. Yeah, that's the, what we call the industrial military complex. Yeah, which is let's say trying to.
One important aspect of this is that university research should be from the very beginning and always public, and it should be more or less without having a license. It should be creative commons. And so military research and academia is a contradiction. Afterwards, but because it is public, you cannot avoid this. I think we have to come to a time where war is impossible, and then all these problems are gone.
Is there a question? Okay.
Do you see a principal difference in IT technology to any other sort of technology and its application to defense, for any sort of material research, any sort of vehicle, even going to public health, that early public health initiatives to reduce infant mortalities were basically just to have more little soldiers coming up. So do you think IT has a particularly special place in this thing, or isn't this just a general moral obligation for people?
Not really a very special, but I think what I tried to point out was that in no other technology it's, let's say, so much taken for granted that that's one unique type of let's say technology. Yeah? Because I think if you do research on materials or on vehicles or whatever, there are distinct differences between the application areas. Of course, there's also the gray area, yeah. But I think it's not so much taken for granted. It's a certain special, and certainly it's about special, yeah.
I just want to say that I think it's it's important that Europe tries to be the conscience, the global conscience, because obviously it doesn't seem like it's going to be coming from the U.S., which is right now the leading developer of these weapons by far, and Europe is really dwarfed in that way. I mean, 1.4 billion going into some of these projects. That's how much the U.S. gave Morsi's military in Egypt. It's just like a little drop in the bucket. So that's one thing that we really need to try to get the whole world on the European Convention on Human Rights issue, and also maybe not so much. Maybe it's kind of good if Europe develops some of this technology, because it also gives Europe some more leverage in trying to keep the U.S. and under control.
Any response to that?
I'm not so sure.
Well, I mean, I trust Europe seems to be better on the human rights issue. So,
okay. But I would have some hopes that this will change in the States. And even if not so soon, then we can start in Europe.
And if there's some kind of employment of these devices,
yeah, but
it's not private, everyone doesn't want them anymore.
But all this would be much more difficult for the United States if, for example, Europe would oppose to it.
Yeah, well,
okay. So, any more questions? I think it has become late, and again we thank you very much for listening, and we hope that some of you at least will take the messages and proliferate them and try to keep informed about what's going on. Thank you.
Yeah, have a good traveling back.